folks, Professor Flame here. I want to talk just a little bit about the history of sex work. First of all, if you are thinking sex work, that's a really weird word. Why doesn't she just call them prostitutes? Excellent question. People who engage in the profession themselves have asked us to refer to them as sex workers and not prostitutes or hookers or whores or anything else. Now, I know we talk about that in FIC and we use hooking really, you know, kind of liberally. So for most of us, like, that kind of discipline is maybe aspirational. I definitely try to say sex worker or sex work as often as possible. There are times I absolutely slip, and I may even in this segment, but I do try very, very carefully to make sure to refer to it as work, because it is, it's labor. It's labor where sex is exchanged for money. This is different than sexual slavery. This is different than sexual trafficking. I'm going to specifically be referring to an entity in which there is an element of consent on behalf of the person performing the work. We can, you know, there's layers of consent, but there is an element of consent. So the history of this, especially because, as we talked about earlier in the segment with Robin, the sexual slavery and within FIC, like, is kind of its own thing. And FICs in which we say that, you know, the sex worker does not have control over their own lives is, you know, we would more often refer to that like as a dark fic and not necessarily as a happily ever after or rom-com like Ferret and Robin and I write. So I'm going to narrow this entirely towards, I guess, the kind of sex workers that that are in a lot of fic, which is there is a level of consent of some, again, of some fashion. I even wrote my longest fic about Steve being a stripper, though, is based in an Omegaverse society in which he has very little choice, but he still made a choice to be an exotic dancer rather than a teacher or whatever else I could have given him options to be. All of that to say, for this purpose and for the purpose of this conversation, when I think about the sociological definition of sex work, which is, again, somebody consents to use their body for the sexual gratification of somebody else in exchange for monetary goods, then exotic dancers do fall into this category. There is debate that I've read whether they should or shouldn't. For the purposes of our conversation today, they are going to. Just because, again, I base sex work when I look at the definitions that are out there and kind of what my research goes over and all the research stuff, I really like making sure it ties to the element of consent. And it also ties to the idea that your body is to bring pleasure and or sexual gratification to somebody else. So whether it's comfort, whether that pleasure is comfort or whatever, but the idea is that you are exchanging goods to use your body to bring someone else pleasure, sexual or otherwise, within the content of this thing. So a couple things out of the way, obviously the stigma around sex work, as far as I am concerned, come largely from the fact that as humans, we are terrible about talking about sex when it's not within the language of procreation. So obviously procreation is generally off the table when we're talking about sex work. Like, that's not the point of this exchange at all. The point is entirely pleasure. And humans, especially in the United States, are really, really shitty at talking about things that are just pleasurable and serve no other pragmatic purpose. However, prostitution wasn't technically outlawed in the United States until 1915, and we'll get to that in a minute. So sex work, see, I slipped it just then. Sex work is the world's oldest profession. That joke is true. We have recorded elements of people exchange of using their body to make money in every recorded society, pretty much. There's some tribal societies where that isn't the case, that, you know, especially in the Andes Mountains, but it's very, very rare. And how the sex work is perceived definitely shifts based on cultural values. There are some where it's a recognized profession, you know, especially now. And so therefore the sex workers have rights and are protected, but in the majority, they are shunned or reviled. They're punished, stoning, imprisonment, death, even just, you know, a real kind of negative concept of them in society. Now, the true double standard is that very few societies ostracize people who buy sex work or criminalize people who buy sex work. There are countries that are changing that, which is great, but, like, that's a thing. The ostracization of sex work has been around since the Greeks and Romans. They actually mandated that sex workers wear distinctive dress, and they paid a lot of really severe taxes, even those that were like temple sex workers, and part of worship of that particular god was engaging in sex with one of the temple guards. Those temple guards, those temple sex workers, still paid really high levels of taxes because the world is wonderful. So there was an idea that maybe in the Middle Ages, and this is pretty common, that a lot of women and down on their luck others, but marginalized groups will often turn to sex work because they have no other option. So, and this was very, very prevalent in the Middle Ages in Europe. And so the Catholic Church was like, you know what, we're going to fund their dowries and we're going to get out of it. But it didn't really work for a whole host of reasons. Prostitution actually really flourished in the Middle Ages in Europe. It was protected and licensed and regulated by law, and it constituted a really big part of public income in most European countries, which is a huge part of the argument now for the decriminalization and legalization of sex work. So public brothels, public brothels, government-run brothels were established in huge cities throughout Europe. For instance, in Toulouse in France, the profits were shared between the city and the university. So students who go to the University of Toulouse now, I mean, it was funded by sex workers. In England, the bordellos were actually originally licensed by the bishops of Winchester and then by Parliament. But there was absolutely state regulation and kind of how that happened. Now, there were stricter controls during the 16th century, partially because the Protestants showed up. You're welcome. And whenever we show up, we bring sexual morality that's a little bit, you know, kind of more strict, shall we say. The Counter-Reformation with the Catholics, the Catholic Church kind of fought back, Reformation II, Electric Boogaloo, as it were. Now, a lot less legalization. But honestly, we know this, no less activity. And so sexually transmitted diseases skyrocketed. The sporadic attempts were made to suppress brothels and such things, but like honestly, like people are, if they're willing to give, if they're willing to do this, it's going to flourish. So the late 19th centuries, we get a lot of Victorian sensibilities. There's a huge variety of changes in Western societies, and there was a real strong revival to suppress sex work. The rise of feminism within that kind of, that's like first wave feminism, like around suffrage. Many came to regard like male complete sexual freedom as a threat to both women's status and public and physical health, which it is. There was also, but not necessarily like this, there is also a major in the Victorian era, lots and lots of awakenings and revivals in various Protestant countries, including the United States. There was massive anti-prostitution campaigns, and they were usually connected with suffrage and temperance, because it was this whole idea of, if we get rid of drinking and prostitutes and we give women the vote and we can all become these buttoned up, I mean, by like the collar, I'm making the gesture where I'm buttoning my collar. You can't see me, but it's all kind of there. So international cooperation kind of started to have to become clear as the trade routes continued to be done, and folks started to realize that some of the movement of sex workers, particularly women, was trafficking. This is where we start getting the first kind of recorded cases of sexual trafficking, which is different than slavery. And there's nuances in there that are important. It is a subsect of slavery, but sex trafficking is specifically for, they are not made for manual labor. They are not, this is not the transatlantic slave trade. I am sure there were some slaves taken from Africa for the sexual gratification exclusively of those that bought them. But this is much more clandestine. There were not markets for sexual slavery. There were not, you know, sex trafficking has always been under the radar, always is kind of what I'm getting to. So in an effort to kind of crack down on this, we hit the League of Nations came together after World War I. And in 1921, they established the Committee on the Traffic in Women and Children. And in 1949, the League of Nations successor, the United Nations, adopted a convention for the suppression of prostitution. Great, cool. All of that is fine. But what really is important for the United States is that in 1910, there was something called the Mann Act, M-A-N-N. after a dude, which prohibited interstate transport of women for immoral purposes. That then opened up the door. By 1915, almost all the states had passed laws that banned brothels or regulated the profits of prostitution, as it were. After World War II, it remained prohibited. Sex work remained prohibited, but it was like unofficially tolerated in a decent chunk of places. And many law enforcement agencies were more concerned with regulating crimes associated with the practice, like theft and robbery committed against clients. This is where you get a lot of the myths that like women would lure men into like their welcoming vaginas and then rob them. This happened very, actually statistically rarely compared to men who would sleep with women and then kill them. But we didn't really keep accurate track of the men that were sleeping with women and then killing them, because why would we do that? That would be silly. There was also quite a lot of pearl clutching over sex trafficking, specifically of white girls. This is another area in which the power of whiteness comes up, and you can see this fear of white girls being sex trafficked and kidnapped and everything, even now. I mean, we can talk about like how many true crime properties have we all consumed where the victims are white women versus women of color or BIPOC in general. It's messy. It's been technically illegal in the United States since 1910, and then 1915. It is legal in some counties in Nevada. There is a growing movement to decriminalize it as an act, and so therefore the workers themselves are not punished for selling themselves. And then, of course, to legalize it, decriminalization is the first step, and then legalization. So just really quick, now let's get into the, I just want to touch really briefly on sex tourism and a lot of things like that in Asian and Middle Eastern countries where it may be completely illegal, but it still thrives. Like, for instance, actually, it is legal in Turkey, and they do that so that there can be health checks for sex workers. But then in Bangladesh, I'm looking at my notes, prostitution is notionally legal. This is what the Bangladeshi embassy website says, but soliciting is prohibited. So we get some gray areas here. Of course, we have some real issues in Southeast Asia, in particular with sex tourism, where men just go on vacation to visit brothels. Thailand's actually tourism economy has been greatly injured by COVID because of the lack of brothels that are open and safe to exist in. Many Latin American countries tolerate prostitution, but they restrict the associated activities. And this would be largely because of the influence of the Catholic Church. In Brazil, for example, brothels, pimping, and child exploitation are illegal, but like the actual act of exchanging sex for money isn't, technically. So in the 1980s is where you really get a lot of people here in the United States waking up and being like, hey, maybe keeping it completely illegal isn't the best idea. And those are for two major reasons. One is the widespread of AIDS, which increased concern about a public health problems caused by prostitution. This is in Africa as well. And so it's like, okay, well, if we make this legal, it's never going away. It's been around forever. If we make it legal, then we can make it safe and we can track it. The other influential development was a renewal of feminist interest and a perspective that prostitution is both a consequence and symptom of gender-based exploitation. So the 1980s is when we actually get the neutral term sex worker instead of prostitution. And sex worker is to describe those involved in commercial sex activities. Once we hit the 1980s is when the conversations get both more stereotypical and a lot more nuanced. You have the pretty woman stereotype, which a lot of middle-class Americans kind of believe that that's what sex work looks like. You're leaning into a car, you're dressing all these things, the hooker with a heart of gold trope. All of that is happening. There are, even with legal decriminalization and legalization, there are some excessive power disparities within sex work. There are madams and johns and pimps and whatever word, a procurer, a facilitator of the sex work. This is happening more and more through websites instead of humans, and that makes it a little bit safer, but not really. I personally love fics that play with that element of danger that is always lurking, for instance. There is also the element that really, for a long time, even though there has always been same-sex sex work, there especially same-sex male sex work. It wasn't really until the 1980s that we started saying it out loud. And some of that is because of AIDS and how AIDS spread and gay men talking more openly about their sexual preferences and practices. Because once again, anything that seems new probably isn't. It's probably just the first time that we're saying things out loud. So all in all, here's the summary of sex work. It is often a choice that people make. Statistically, we are told that it is also often a choice that people make out of desperation. They do not feel that they have any other choice, that they are, while they are potentially consenting in the moment of some way, or they've consented to this life, i.e. they haven't chosen to kill themselves, to die by suicide. They haven't chosen another profession. They haven't chosen that desperation. They are perhaps they're under duress of some fashion in which potentially the consent is a little bit cloudier. There are statistically, and research tells us, just as many sex workers that really like what they do. Of course, these tend to be the upper echelons. They tend to not be the people trading sex for drugs, for instance. Just as many stories as there are about desperation, there are stories of enjoyment and pleasure. And that's an important tension to keep in mind that I think we play with in fic a little bit, but we probably don't really consciously play with in life. And earlier in the episode, you hear Robin kind of say, well, maybe we don't write a lot of fics because we always want to be on the side of the sex worker. And I hope we are. I hope we are always on the side of the sex worker, realizing that they've made choices or they've had choices made for them, or both of those things are true. And no matter where they fall on the consent or pleasure scale, they are humans with dignity that deserve to be protected. I am personally, I'll say this, very in favor of the legalization of sex work within the United States for the simple fact that I really feel like they should be able to get health insurance. My answer to just about everything in the United States is, does this allow somebody to get health insurance? Cool, then I'd like it to be legal. So I'm a big fan of that. I have several contacts and a couple close friends actually who have in the past or are currently engaging in sex work. And they are all there entirely by consent. Even the ones that you would might look at as a little down and out, I'm using air quotes, very much enjoy their jobs. Not all the time, but on the whole, they're pretty happy with it. I've also talked to contacts for research purposes where it's a circle of hell and they want out as soon as possible. My personal relationships are with people that quite enjoy it. And I'll tell you the stories I get from them are the best. But no matter what, no matter how they got there, I want to say it again, they are human beings who deserve dignity, respect, and the protections that the rest of us are afforded as well. And so I would very much like a legalization movement to gain even more steam here in the United States. This is complicated though. There's lots of very well-intentioned and lovely people that want to argue for it against it and all that kind of stuff. I wanted to just unpack this a little bit and spend a little bit of time talking about sex work and or prostitution because those words are used interchangeably, even though, yes, more and more sex workers are asking us to use that neutrality. I do have several contacts that prefer the word prostitute, by the way. They like it. I think they like that it's gritty. I think they like that it's a little dirtier, to be honest, just knowing those particular people. But I wanted us to sit with this a little bit longer. And like, yeah, I love writing. Like, I love reading Tony as a sex worker. I loved writing Steve as a exotic dancer in an Omegaverse. I love playing with these tensions of consent and where on the consent scale does it fall? Because consent, even though we talk about it a lot as a binary, like it's a yes, no, it's not. Everything's gray. Everything's a scale. Everything's a spectrum. And consent is the same way. When you take systems of oppression and privilege into case, absolutely nothing on this planet is black and white. So that has been your Professor Flame Corner for this episode. Please let me know if you have missed this segment. I haven't done one in a while. And if there's other topics you'd like me to cover, discuss, kind of break down from the, nerdy perspective. We've got Ferret covering grammar pretty well. I can't do that. I'm still scared of semicolons, but I can talk a little bit about social systems. So if there's others that you'd like to know more about, I'd love to talk to you. All right, everyone. It's time for your favorite segment and mine to rope off. Ferret.
Give us the update.
Okay, so last time we spoke, we had just kicked off that weekend's poll, and we had Huddling for Warmth versus Friends with Benefits, which is like almost too combinable and delicious. And I was really curious what people were going to say. I did not have a strong prediction, but there was a strong winner. Did you have a strong feeling that one was going to take it?
No, I actually thought it was going to be a really close toss up.
Yeah, so did I. Well, Huddling for Warmth stole the show with 64%, and Friends with Benefits,
oh my gosh,
gets kicked into the loser's bracket with only 36.
There must have been some sort of like subtle campaign to whip up support for that one.
Well, you know, I think that it turns out that Friends with Benefits is one of those things that the people who like it a lot, but it's a smaller contingent of people who like it.
Interesting.
That's my
opinion. I guess I can see that. I guess I can see that. Although I just feel like Friends to Lovers always takes a detour through Friends with Benefits.
I guess it depends if they sleep together before they're lovers, if you know what I mean. Like Friends to Lovers doesn't have to have sex in the middle phase. They could fall in love, declare their love, and then have sex for the first time. Whereas Friends with Benefits, you'd have to be having the benefits before the lovers kicked in. So you definitely could do both, but I'm not sure that they necessarily always overlap.
No, you're right. It must just be the ones that I gravitate towards.
Yeah, totally valid.
This was a confirmation bias situation and not a reality. I was like, but they're the same thing. Oh no, wait, Flame. They're not. Your kink is just the same. Got it. No problem. Okay.
I think that Friends with Benefits almost always follows a Friends to Lovers arc. But I don't think that Friends to Lovers always follows a Friends with Benefits arc. If that makes sense.
Yes. Sorry, I had to do that math. Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's true. And I think,
you know, if we're going to have like a shippy, happy ending, then Friends with Benefits sort of inevitably does the Friends to Lovers thing. It's just that they're having sex in the middle part too.
Yeah. And it's also just seemingly like what I've been writing a little bit lately. Like, I mean, as I say that today, I literally just posted a like adorable, like strangers to idiots to Friends to Lovers thing. But everything else I've been writing has been like, oh, we're really good friends and let's fuck. And then we'll catch feelings. So I might like literally, yeah, just be in my own confirmation bias cycle.
Yeah. Leaning into that. You know, I haven't written a whole lot of Friends with Benefits. I really like reading it, but it's not one that I've written a bunch of. But yeah, I really like it. But I was not, I was not expecting it to get beaten so soundly by Huddling for Warmth, which I also really like, but also seems a little bit more specific. Like Huddling for Warmth,
it seems more niche.
Like it requires like an interest in Hurt Comfort, which like I get, but Hurt Comfort didn't win last year, and it requires
I don't think it requires an interest in Hurt Comfort.
You because think that I've read lots and can be entirely like a positive.
Oh my gosh, my most popular Huddling for Warmth fic involves absolutely no Hurt Comfort.
Okay, but here's my thing. To me, that's cuddling for warmth and not huddling for warmth. A huddle implies risk or danger from the cold to me.
I think you are a small percentage of people who interpret it that way.
Yeah. So, because I've seen people tag things with cuddling for warmth as well, which I could totally like, you're out camping and you're sharing a sleeping bag because it's cold out and hands wander. Totally get it. I'm not sure I would tag that huddling for warmth, but I'm the one who put the trope in as huddling for warmth. And
that's true. So you are showing your bias towards Hurt Comfort.
Yeah, I could have put cuddling for warmth. I don't know. That's tricky. I'm going to have to do a little tag statistics and see if huddling versus cuddling, which one's canonized and like, how do they intersect and
how do they intersect? Yeah. When other people talk about them, I think people use that more interchangeably than we are currently having the conversation.
No, I'm sure.
So that's interesting that for you, it has to take a detour. I think it's more niche because there's fewer ways to write it. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, I can think
you
of
have to put them in the situation where they're cold.
Like, yeah, there's only so many things you can do. Whereas, you know, like,
yeah, it's like weather.
Yeah, like water. Friends with benefits. I'm sitting here and I'm like, okay, there are at least 400 ways into this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But huddling for warmth, I could think of like five. Like, even if I take out the hurt comfort question, like, even if I treat huddling and cuddling as interchangeable, which I personally do, but I see why you don't, and I, you know, bless it and approve it. I still can only think of like five or six ways into that story.
Mm.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Yeah, I definitely thought it was going to be a lot closer because I also just thought of them as one trope. Like, I love to use huddling for warmth as how we get friends with benefits. So, like, that's one that connects really well for me.
Yeah, and the only comment I got was basically, why not both?
Yeah.
So, but as usual, this makes me want to ask follow-up questions. Like, is for the 64% who voted for huddling for warmth, I want to know, did you see it in an angsty way or like a hurt comforty way? Or like, is the cold truly threatening?
Yeah.
Or is it more just the comfort part? Like, does it encompass both for you? Does it encompass only one of the two of that dynamic for you? Like, what are you picturing when you vote for huddling for warmth? But, you know, that's not how Drop Off works. So I sit here not knowing. But if you want to tell me, listeners, please do. I would love to know. So that was, you know, 2 weeks ago when you heard from us last. As always, we had an in-between poll in the weekends between posts. And that one was another runaway winner, even more extreme, but you may be less surprised. We had Slow Burn versus Body Swap. This
two of Flame's least favorite tropes up against each other.
So you abstained.
I abstained. Yeah. Sorry, guys. Not those are not for me.
I'm not surprised that Slow Burn won 76% of the vote. Body Swap took 24%. Not too shabby, actually. That's a fair interest in Body Swap. A quarter of y'all like Body Swap, or you at least like it more than you like Slow Burn. I think that fundamentally, I mean, while I do believe that it is sort of possible, it's possible to have a short Slow Burn fic. Traditionally, Slow Burns are longer. So like you could have a short fic that shows a lot of time passing, and therefore we can call that a Slow Burn. But I also feel like it's just kind of one of those, if you like, I mean, last year Mutual Pining won. If you like Mutual Pining, Slow Burn is often one of the sort of like foundational elements of that. Like, we got to make them pine for a while before we get that satisfaction. So,
see, I think this is just where, like, this is a personal interpretation, because I love Mutual Pining, and like, I love Mutual Pining. I hate Slow Burn because, like, the knife edge between those two things flips really quickly for me. Like, because part of Mutual Pining that makes it good for me is justifiable reasons as to why they cannot be together and why they are just pining for a long fic. For a short fic, they can just be idiots and not use their word. But for a long fic, for me, I need personal baggage or a profession or something that is keeping them apart.
Okay. So how is that not Slow Burn for you?
Because Slow Burn for me takes too long to get there. So like, if a 300K fic and they don't get together until 250, that's too slow of a burn and I'm done. So like, right, it's a pacing issue for me.
But you
so when I say something's a slow
burn, that's a slow burn.
Possibly, yeah. But I would just tag that as mutual pining. And this is my own thing. When I say it's a slow burn, I'm usually being derisive. Like, I'm usually judging it and saying I didn't like it. It was too slow. So like for me, if it's a slow burn, I can't feel forward momentum within the relationship. They're just spinning their wheels.
Okay. For me, slow burn means that it's not an instant, it's not necessarily like an instant attraction and an instant acknowledgement from them that they want a relationship. Their relationship develops slowly, but the word slow is relative here. Like I say, you could do a 1K fic that was a slow burn. If you talked about how they were friends in school first and then, you know, they realized over two decades of being friends that they were right for each other and they found love and got married. You could do that in 1K and I would still call it a slow burn.
That's fair. And so like, this is again, like your mileage may vary on the terms.
Yeah,
like,
that's interesting. I'm curious how people interpret slow burn then. I mean, clearly.
Yeah. And I'm sure more people interpret it
a fave because it got 76% of the vote. We'll see how it does obviously, up against more specific ones in the future.
But I know people that, people who love long fix, one of the reasons they say they love it is they love a slow burn. And there's a really famous contemporary romance author named Mariana Zapata, who I cannot stand because her slow burns are the slowest of burns. Like it is a simmer the entire time. And she writes like 500-600 page books. But people who love her are like rabid and devoted. And like, I made it through one and was like, fuck this, never doing this again. Like, this is like, you didn't. So it's, I guess so much of it for me in enjoyment of a fic is plotting and pacing.
Yeah.
And that's just, sometimes that's just deeply personal. And so something that you may call a slow burn, I may call just mutual pining. And I'm happy with the progression of the plotting and the pacing. But noping, like, I think one of the things that I am like low key, like secretly most obsessed with in any fiction I consume is the pacing.
Yeah, interesting. I'm curious what other people's feelings are on that as always. So that one too, I want to know how you guys see slow burn. We need like some kind of like trope off follow up that's like, and now write an essay about what each one means to you.
What's so funny is so far, every time we've done this, everybody has come down on your side. So you are the normative interpretation and I'm the weirdo outlier. So we'll see if this continues as we go through this.
I spent a lot of time on Fandler.
It's true. What are you doing this week? What's going on?
This week, as always, it was posted yesterday. You've got 2 days to vote. So it'll finish Monday morning sometime, depending on where you are, Monday morning EST. And what I posted is going to be an interesting one, but I don't think we're going to be super surprised by the outcome. we've got humor/crack versus found family.
Oh, wow.
That's a hard one to be up against. but we'll see. We'll see. We'll see. And even if the one I think might lose does lose, it'll be their first loss. So they'll pop down into the loser's bracket and they'll have a chance to come back from that and still end up scooping it in the end. But I know how you feel already. So that'll be a short conversation on our next episode.
Potentially, yeah. But we also know that I can take anything that's supposed to be a short conversation and turn it into a thesis. So we'll see.
But yeah, this is one where I'm curious what people have to say, how they interpret those things. And definitely combinable because one's kind of a genre and one's a trope. So you could absolutely combine those things very easily. But if you have a specific prompt, I would love to laugh myself silly hearing them. So hook me up. But yeah, that is our trope off update. And next time we talk, we'll talk about who wins from humor, crack versus found family, what our in-between challenge was, and what we'll be running next time we're talking.
This segment is the first in a series of Grammar Must-Elid minis that I'm calling Mastering Verb Forms. We're going to talk about how verb conjugations form, different tenses in English, and subject-verb agreement, but I'm going to spread it out over a few segments so it's not too overwhelming. This segment is going to end up being a bit foundational, introducing some of the terms and the concepts and explaining why this is pretty hard to get a hold of. As always, if you end up with questions, please let me know, and I can either answer them right there, wherever we're talking, or make them part of a future segment, or probably both. So let's break down a bit what tenses and conjugations are. First up, tenses. Verb tenses alter a verb to indicate when an action is taking place. There are 3 main verb tenses, past, present, and future, and within them, 4 further breakdowns, simple, perfect, continuous, and perfect continuous. There are more verb forms than the tenses I just listed, and we'll break those down in another segment and get into the details of how we form them and what they mean. So let's get into conjugation. Conjugation is the process of altering the verb form to fit both the subject and the tense. Even when there's no apparent change in the form of a verb, it still carries that information with it, but it can make it harder to spot and harder to understand why things are formed the way that they are. Each verb form has the infinitive form. This is the base, unconjugated form that carries no tense or agreement information. In English, the infinitives have the word to as part of them. To run, to walk, to dance, to kiss. When we form tenses, we drop the to and we change either the end or the middle, or honestly, sometimes the whole thing, of the verb to make it fit both the tense and the subject. So for to kiss, in simple present, we would have I kiss, you kiss, he kisses, she kisses, they kiss, we kiss. It can be somewhat deceiving because I kiss and you kiss appear to be the same verb form, but in a silent meta way, they are not. And it's best to think of them as homophonic versions of different words because those similarities are not universal across all verbs, sadly. So what about verbs that do look different? Well, unfortunately, English has around 200 irregular verbs. That means all 200 have to be memorized because their conjugation patterns don't match other verbs. Drive, for example. I drive, you drive, he drives, she drives, they drive, we drive. That all looks the same as kiss, but in simple past we get I drove, you drove, he drove, she drove, they drove, we drove. Whereas for kiss, we get kissed. I kissed, you kissed, etc., which is the regular pattern. While you may have talked about regular and irregular verbs when studying a second language, it rarely comes up when studying your first. If English is your first and only language, you may never have talked about regular and irregular verbs. Just learn the exceptions naturally through exposure and correction. I think English is both hard and easy when it comes to verb conjugations. As you could see with drove and kissed, often agreement with the subject is the same across the board, whereas with a language like French, those are often different. But when you balance that with a huge list of irregulars, and some of those irregulars are very, very irregular, it can make it really hard to understand the basis behind the patterns that your brain automatically knows how to do because of the way humans learn language. And that in turn makes it hard to learn English as a second language, and also hard for native speakers to know what to do when they're faced with a word they've never encountered before. The most challenging part of tenses, in my opinion, is how naturally we learn to conjugate in our first language. When something is that innate and we're learning it so effectively well before we learn it in school, where if we're lucky, we might learn how it works, it makes it very difficult both to understand why we do it and also to learn it by rote for second and third languages. So that's kind of a broad overview of tenses and conjugation, what they're used for and how they're formed, but also sort of an acknowledgement that this is hard and it might be new for you. And you might know how naturally how to do all of the things we're going to talk about, but you've never really fully processed the structure behind it. So hopefully this gives you a little bit of that structure to start out. In the next segment, we're going to talk about the verb tenses I mentioned earlier. Then in another, we'll talk about the non-tense forming verb constructions like the gerund and what participles and auxiliaries are. And in the last of this series, we'll talk about some other tense forms like imperative, conditional, subject, subjunctive, and more, which again, you may have only heard of if you studied a second language. If you have any questions, let me know, and I hope this helped.
Hey there, fandom. This is Only More Love, and I'm back with your Pod on the Suit events forecast. This is where I'll tell you all about what's going on, challenge-wise, in a Marvel fandom near you. So put on your seatbelt and let's go. The usual note before I start with the current events. You'll be able to find everything I mention in this forecast, linked and explained, in the show notes for each episode over on podonthesuit.com. Now on to the fun stuff. The mods for the What to Finish auction have announced a mini auction round to support Asian communities in light of recent events. Signups will open on June 15th, and the rest of the schedule, as well as guidelines and other info, can be found on their blog. A reminder that the Marvel Reverse Bang is back, but different. With its new six-phase formula, the mods aim to find you a partner, no matter how rare your ship, by dividing the many parts of our fandom into their own phase, and therefore their own bang within the bang. For more information and detailed rules and dates on each phase, please visit the blog. Signups are currently open for the Earth's Mightiest Phase. Sign-ups for The Star-Spangled Big Bang are open to artists until June 4th, with claims happening on June 11th. Centering around Team Cap characters, this bang welcomes any fic, shippy or gen, that focuses on at least one of the characters that make up the Team Cap handle. The minimum word count is 10K, and posting is set for September. The Super Family Exchange signups remain open until April 15th, with a deadline for creators to have finished their work set for June 22nd. You can find more info on their blog, as well as on their Discord server. The Shrunky Clunks Big Bang is also still open for artist signups until April 17th. A Stucky Week has been announced well in advance, as it will run from July 5th to July 11th. But prompts are already available on their blog, so please go check them out, as well as their rules, so you can prep beforehand. The Iron Strange Big Bang is back, with a minimum of 12,000 words for writers and 2 illustrations for artists. Today, April 11th, is the last day for authors to sign up, while artists have until May 17th. Claims will be happening from June 28th through July 12th, and posting is set to begin on November 12th. The Iron Husbands Bingo is back, and you can sign up for a personalized card until May 1st. Also open until May 1st is the Iron Husbands Big Bang. The Bang allows for both a mini and Big Bang options, one for 5K and one for 15K and upwards, of course. Claims will take place on June 19th, with posting spanning the entire month of September. Claims for the Sam Wilson Fest are open and will remain that way until April 23rd. Posting will happen between April 24th and May 2nd. There are no minimums and all mediums are allowed. Please don't miss out. Signups and fills for the following are also still ongoing. Cap IM Bingo, Marvel Fluff Bingo, Marvel Holiday Fest, Cap IM Com Remix Events and Bingo, STB, Steve, Tony, Bucky Bingo, as well as the Lights on Park Avenue monthly prompts. And that's it for this episode, folks. This has been your events forecast. We hope to see you next episode. Until then, please be safe and happy shipping.
And that is a wrap on episode 4. Thanks again to Wolfie for our cover art and to Marie Only and the Pottscast staff for all their help.
As always, please hit us up anywhere we are available to chat about this episode. And if you're listening to us on a podcatcher service like iTunes or Spotify, your reviews and ratings really help other listeners find the pod. So thank you for that.
As always, this is your fandom podcast, and we want to make it the best experience it can be for you. If you've got comments or suggestions, we want to hear them. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Pod on the Suit. Thanks for joining us.